Village children shouted the news in the distance, and Mother Morlan came jogging with her skirts tucked up, and the curraghs at sea came rowing madly home. The young princelings of Lothian got off their donkeys as if in a trance and joined the circle. The circle itself began to press inward on its focus, moving as slowly and as silently as the minute hand of a clock, except for the suppressed shouts from the late arrivals, who fell silent themselves as soon as they were within the influence. The circle was contracting because it wanted to touch the knights. Not now, not for half an hour or so, not until the examination was over. Perhaps never. But it would have liked to touch them in the end, partly to be sure that they were real, partly to sum up the price of their clothes. And as the pricing was continued, three things began to happen. Mother Morlan and the old wives started to say the rosary, while the young women pinched each other and giggled. The men, having doffed their caps in deference to the praying, began to exchange in Gaelic such remarks as, "Look at the black man, God, between us and harm," or, "Do they be naked at bedtime?" or, "How do they get the iron pots off them, whatever?" And in the minds of both women and men, irrespective of age or circumstance, there began to grow, almost visibly, almost tangibly, the enormous, the incalculable miasma, which is the leading feature of the Gaelic brain. These were knights of the Sassenachs, they were thinking, for they could tell by the armour, and if so, knights of that very King Arthur, against whom their own king had for the second time revolted. Had they come with typical Sassenach cunning, so as to take King Lot in the rear? Had they come as representatives of the feudal overlord, the landlord, so as to make an assessment for the next scutage? Were they fifth columnists? More complicated even than this, for surely no Sassenach could be so simple as to come in the garb of the Sassenach. Were they perhaps not representatives of King Arthur at all? Were they, for some purpose almost too cunning for belief, only disguised as themselves? Where was the catch? There always was one in everything. The people of the circle closed in, their jaws dropping even further, their crooked bodies hunching into the shapes of sacks and scarecrows, their small eyes glinting in every direction with unfathomable subtlety, their faces assuming an expression of dogged stupidity even more vacant than they actually were. The knights drew closer for protection. In point of fact, they did not know that England was at war with Orkney. They had been involved in a quest which had kept them away from the latest news. Nobody in Orkney was likely to tell them.
"Don't look just now," said King Pellinore, "but there are some people. Do you think they're all right?"
Chapter 6. In Caerleon, everything was at sixes and sevens in preparation for the second campaign. Merlin had made suggestions about the way to win it, but as these involved an ambush with secret aid from abroad, they had had to be kept dark. Lot's slowly approaching army was so much more numerous than the king's forces that it had been necessary to resort to stratagems. The way in which the battle was to be fought was a secret only known to four people. The common citizens, who were in ignorance of the higher policy, had a great deal to do. There were pikes to be ground to a fine edge, so that the grindstones in the town were roaring day and night. There were thousands of arrows to be dressed, so that there were lights in the fletchers' houses at all hours. And the unfortunate geese on the commons were continually being chased by excited yeomen who wanted feathers. The royal peacocks were as bare as an old broom. Most of the crack shots liked to have what Chaucer calls peacock arwis, because they were more classy, and the smell of boiling glue rose to high heaven. The armourers, accomplishing the knights, hammered away with musical clinks, working double shifts at it, and the blacksmiths shod the chargers, and the nuns never stopped knitting comforters for the soldiers or making the kind of bandages which were called tents. King Lot had already named a rendezvous for the battle at Bedegraine. The King of England painfully climbed the 208 steps which led to Merlin's tower room and knocked on the door. The magician was inside, with Archimedes sitting on the back of his chair, busily trying to find the square root of minus one. He had forgotten how to do it.
"Merlin," said the king, panting, "I want to talk to you."
He closed his book with a bang, leapt to his feet, seizing his wand of lignum vitae, and rushed at Arthur as if he were trying to shoo away a stray chicken.
"Go away!" he shouted. "What are you doing here? What do you mean by it? Aren't you the King of England? Go away and send for me. Get out of my room. I never heard of such a thing. Go away at once and send for me."
"But I'm here."
"No, you're not," retorted the old man resourcefully, and he pushed the king out of the door, slamming it in his face.
"Well," said Arthur, and he went off sadly down the 208 stairs. An hour later, Merlin presented himself in the royal chamber, in answer to a summons which had been delivered by a page.
"That's better," he said, and sat down comfortably on a carpet chest.
"Stand up," said Arthur, and he clapped his hands for a page to take away the seat.
Merlin stood up, boiling with indignation. The whites of his knuckles blanched as he clenched them.
"About our conversation on the subject of chivalry," began the king in an airy tone.
"I don't recollect such a conversation."
"No?"
"I have never been so insulted in my life."
"But I am the king," said Arthur. "You can't sit down in front of a king."
"Rubbish!"
Arthur began to laugh more than was seemly, and his foster brother, Sir Kay, and his old guardian, Sir Ector, came out from behind the throne where they had been hiding. Kay took off Merlin's hat and put it on Sir Ector, and Sir Ector said,
"Well, bless my soul, now I am a nigromancer. Hocus pocus!"
Then everybody began laughing, including Merlin eventually, and seats were sent for so that they could sit down, and bottles of wine were opened so that it should not be a dry meeting. "You see," he said proudly, "I have summoned a council." There was a pause, for it was the first time that Arthur had made a speech, and he wanted to collect his wits for it. "Well," said the king, "it is about chivalry. I want to talk about that." Merlin was immediately watching him with a sharp eye. His knobbed fingers fluttered among the stars and secret signs of his gown, but he would not help the speaker. You might say that this moment was the critical one in his career, the moment towards which he had been living backward for heaven knows how many centuries, and now he was to see for certain whether he had lived in vain. "I have been thinking," said Arthur, "about might and right. I don't think things ought to be done because you are able to do them. I think they should be done because you ought to do them. After all, a penny is a penny in any case, however much might is exerted on either side to prove that it is or is not. Is that plain?" Nobody answered. "Well, I was talking to Merlin on the battlements one day, and he mentioned that the last battle we had, in which 700 kerns were killed, was not so much fun as I had thought it was. Of course, battles are not fun when you come to think about it. I mean, people ought not to be killed, ought they? It is better to be alive." "Very well. But the funny thing is that Merlin was helping me to win battles. He is still helping me, for that matter, and we hope to win the Battle of Bedegraine together when it comes off."
"We will," said Sir Ector, who was in the secret.
"That seems to me to be inconsistent. Why does he help me to fight wars, if they're bad things?" There was no answer from anybody, and the king began to speak with agitation.
"I could only think," said he, beginning to blush, "I could only think that I... that we... that he... that he wanted me to win them for a reason."
He paused and looked at Merlin, who turned his head away.
"The reason was..."
"Was it?"
"The reason was that if I could be the master of my kingdom by winning these two battles, I could stop them afterwards, and then do something about the business of might. Have I guessed? Was I right?"
The magician did not turn his head, and his hands lay still in his lap.
"I was," exclaimed Arthur, and he began talking so quickly that he could hardly keep up with himself. "You see," he said, "might is not right, but there is a lot of might knocking about in this world, and something has to be done about it. It is as if people were half horrible and half nice. Perhaps they're even more than half horrible, and when they're left to themselves, they run wild. You get the average baron that we see nowadays, people like Sir Bruce Sans-Pitier, who simply go clodhopping round the country dressed in steel and doing exactly what they please for sport. It is our Norman idea about the upper classes having a monopoly of power without reference to justice. Then the horrible side gets uppermost, and there is thieving and rape and plunder and torture. The people become beasts. But you see, Merlin is helping me to win my two battles so that I can stop this. He wants me to put things right. Lot and Uriens and Anguish and those, they are the old world, the old-fashioned order who want to have their private will. I've got to vanquish them with their own weapons. They force it upon me, because they live by force. And then the real work will begin. This battle at Bedegrain is the preliminary, you see. It is after the battle that Merlin is wanting me to think about."
Arthur paused again for comment or encouragement, but the magician's face was turned away. It was only Sir Ector, sitting next to him, who could see his eyes.
"Now, what I have thought," said Arthur, "is this. Why can't you harness might so that it works for right? I know it sounds nonsense, but I mean, you can't just say there is no such thing. The might is there, in the bad half of people, and you can't neglect it, you can't cut it out, but you might be able to direct it, if you see what I mean, so that it was useful instead of bad."
The audience was interested. They leaned forward to listen, except Merlin.
"My idea is that if we can win this battle in front of us and get a firm hold of the country, then I will institute a sort of order of chivalry. I will not punish the bad knights or hang Lot, but I will try to get them into our order. We shall have to make it a great honour, you see, and make it fashionable and all that. Everybody must want to be in. And then I shall make the oath of the order that might is only to be used for right. Do you follow? The knights in my order will ride all over the world, still dressed in steel and whacking away with their swords. That will give an outlet for wanting to whack, you understand, an outlet for what Merlin calls the fox-hunting spirit. But they will be bound to strike only on behalf of what is good, to defend virgins against Sir Bruce, and to restore what has been done wrong in the past, and to help the oppressed and so forth. Do you see the idea? It will be using the might instead of fighting against it, and turning a bad thing into a good." "There, Merlin, that is all I can think of. I have thought as hard as I could, and I suppose I am wrong as usual. But I did think. I can't do any better. Please say something."
The magician stood up straight as a pillar, stretched out his arms in both directions, looked at the ceiling, and said the first few words of the Nunc Dimittis. Chapter 7. The situation at Dunlothian was complicated. Nearly every situation tended to be when it was connected with King Pellinore, even in the wildest north. In the first place,
He was in love. That was why he had been weeping in the boat. He explained it to Queen Morgause on the first opportunity, because he was lovesick, not seasick. What had happened was this. The king had been hunting the questing beast a few months earlier on the south coast of Grammary, when the animal had taken to the sea. She had swum away, her serpentine head undulating on the surface like a swimming grass snake, and the king had hailed a passing ship which looked as if it were off to the Crusades. Sir Grummore and Sir Palomides had been in the ship, and they had kindly turned it round to pursue the beast. The three of them had arrived on the coast of Flanders, where the beast had disappeared in a forest, and there, while they were staying at a hospitable castle, Pellinore had fallen in love with the Queen of Flanders' daughter. This was fine so far as it went, for the lady of his choice was a managing, middle-aged, stout-hearted creature who could cook, ride a straight line, and make beds. But the hopes of all parties had been dashed at the start by the arrival of the magic barge. The three knights had got into it and sat down to see what would happen, because knights were never supposed to refuse adventure. But the barge had promptly sailed away of its own accord, leaving the Queen of Flanders' daughter anxiously waving her pocket handkerchief. The questing beast had thrust her head out of the forest before they lost sight of land, looking, so far as they could see at the distance, even more surprised than the lady. After that, they'd gone on sailing till they arrived in the Out Isles. And the further they went, the more lovesick the king had become, which made his company intolerable. He spent the time writing poems and letters, which could never be posted, or telling his companions about the princess, whose nickname in her family circle was Piggy. A state of affairs like this might have been bearable in England, where people like the Pellinores did sometimes turn up, and even won a sort of tolerance from their fellow men. But in Lothian and Orkney, where Englishmen were tyrants, it achieved an almost supernatural impossibility. None of the islanders could understand what King Pellinore was trying to cheat them out of by pretending to be himself, and it was thought wiser and safer not to acquaint any of the visiting knights with the facts about the war against Arthur. It was better to wait until their plots had been penetrated. On top of this, there was a trouble which distressed the children in particular. Queen Morgause had set her cap at the visitors.
"What was our mother at doing?" asked Gawain, as they made their way towards St. Tordelbach's cell one morning. "With the knights on the mountain?"
Gaheris answered with some difficulty after a long pause.
"They were at hunting a unicorn."
"How do you do that?"
"There must be a virgin to attract it."
"Our mother," said
Agravain, who also knew the details,
"went on a unicorn hunt, and she was the virgin for them."
His voice sounded strange as he made this announcement.
Gareth protested, "I did not know she was wanting a unicorn. She has never said so."
Agravain looked at him sideways, cleared his throat, and quoted,
"Half a word is sufficient to the wise man."
"How do you know this?" asked Gawain.
"We listened."
They had a way of listening on the spiral stairs during the times when they were excluded from their mother's interest. Gaheris explained with unusual freedom, since he was a taciturn boy.
"She told Sir Grummore that this king's lovesick melancholy could be dispelled by interesting him in his old pursuits. They were at saying that this king is in the habit of hunting a beast which has become lost. So she said that they were to hunt a unicorn instead, and she would be the virgin for them. They were surprised, I think."
They walked in silence, until Gawain suggested, almost as if it were a question,
"I was hearing it told that the king is in love with a woman out of Flanders, and that Sir Grummore is married already. Also, the Saracen is black in his skin?"
No answer.
"It was a long hunt," said Gareth. "I hear they did not catch one."
"Do these knights enjoy to be playing this game with our mother?"
Gaheris explained for the second time. Even if he were silent, he was not unobservant.
I do not think they would be understanding at all.
They plodded on, reluctant to disclose their thoughts. St. Torlbach's cell was like an old-fashioned straw beehive, except that it was bigger and made of stone. It had no windows and only one door through which you had to crawl.
"Your Holiness!"
they shouted when they got there, kicking the heavy, unmortared stones.
"Your Holiness! We have come to hear a story!"
He was a source of mental nourishment to them, a sort of guru, as Merlin had been to Arthur, who gave them what little culture they were ever to get. They resorted to him like hungry puppies anxious for any kind of eatable when their mother had cast them out. He had taught them to read and write.
"Ah, now," said the saint, sticking his head out of the door, "the prosperity of God on you this morning. The self-same prosperity on you. Is there any news at you?"
"There is not,"
said Gawain, suppressing the unicorn. St. Tordelbach heaved a deep sigh.
"There is none at me either," he said.
"Could you tell us a story?"
"Dim stories now. There doesn't be any good in them. What would I be wanting to tell you a story for, and me and my heresies? 'Tis 40 years since I fought a natural battle, and not a one of me looking upon a white colleen all the time. So how would I be telling stories?"
"You could tell us a story without any colleens or battles in it."
"And what would be the good of that now?"
he exclaimed indignantly, coming out into the sunlight.
"If you were to fight a battle,"
said Gawain, but he left out about the colleens,
"you might feel better."
"My sorrow," cried Tordelbach. "What do I want to be a saint for at all is my puzzle. If I could fetch one crack at somebody with me old shillelagh,"
here he produced a frightful-looking weapon from under his gown, "wouldn't it be better than all the saints in Ireland?"
"Tell us about the shillelagh."
He examined the club carefully, while His Holiness told them how a good one should be made. He told them that only a root growth was any good, as common branches were apt to break, especially if they were of crab tree, and how to smear the club with lard, and wrap it up, and bury it in a dunghill while it was being straightened, and polish it with black lead and grease. He showed the hole where the lead was poured in, and the nails through the end, and the notches near the handle which stood for ancient scalps. Then he kissed it reverently, and replaced it under his gown with a heartfelt sigh. He was play-acting, and putting on the accent.
"Tell us the story about the black arm which came down the chimney."
"Ah, the heart isn't in me," said the saint. "I haven't the heart of a hare. It's bewitched I am entirely."
"I think we're bewitched too," said Gareth. "Everything seems to go wrong."
"There was this one in it," began Tordelbach, "and she was a woman. There was a husband living in Morlin Vidge with this woman. There was only one little girl that they had between them. One day the man went out to cut in the bog, and when it was time for his dinner, this woman sent the little girl out with his bit of dinner. When the father was sitting to his dinner, the little girl suddenly made a cry. 'Look now, father, do you see the large ship out yonder, under the horizon? I could make it come in to the shore beneath the coast.' 'You could not do that,' said the father. 'I am bigger than you are, and I could not do it myself.' 'Well, look at me now,' said the little girl. And she went to the well that was near there, and made a stirring in the water. The ship came in at the coast." "She was a witch," explained Gaheris. "It was the mother was the witch," said the saint, and continued with his story. "Now," says she, "I could make the ship be struck against the coast." "You could not do that," says the father. "Well, look at me now," says the little girl, and she jumped into the well. The ship was dashed against the coast and broke into 1,000 pieces. "Who has taught you to do these things?" asked the father. My mother? And when you do be working, she teaches me to do things with the tub at home.
Why did she jump into the well? Asked Agrabaine. Was she wet?
Hush!
When this man got home to his wife, he set down his turf cutter and put himself in his sitting. Then he said, What have you been teaching to the little girl? I do not like to have this pisog in my house, and will not stay with you any longer. So he went away, and they never saw one of him again. I do not know how they went on after that.
It must be dreadful to have a witch for a mother, said Gareth, when he had finished.
Or for a wife, said Gawain. It's worse not to be having a wife at all, said the saint, and he vanished into his beehive with startling suddenness, like the man in the Swiss weather clock who retires into a hole when it is going to be fine.
The boys sat round the door without surprise, waiting for something else to happen. They considered in their minds the questions of wells, witches, unicorns, and the practices of mothers.
I make this proposition, said Gareth unexpectedly, my heroes, that we have a unicorn hunt of our own.
They looked at him.
It would be better than not having anything. We have not seen our mammy for 1 week.
She has forgotten us, said Agrabaine bitterly.
She has not so. You're not to speak in that way of our mother.
It is true. We have not been to serve at dinner, even.
It is because she has a necessity to be hospitable to these knights.
No, it is not.
What is it, then?
I will not say.
If we could do a unicorn hunt, said Gareth, and bring this unicorn which she requires, perhaps we would be allowed to serve.
They considered the idea with a beginning of hope.
St. Torlbach! They shouted. Come out again! We want to catch a unicorn!
The saint put his head out of the hole and examined them suspiciously.
What is a unicorn? What are they like? How do you catch them?
He nodded the head solemnly and vanished for the second time, to return on all fours in a few moments with a learned volume, the only secular work in his possession. Like most saints, he made his living by copying manuscripts and drawing pictures for them.
You need a maid for bait, they told him. We have a gaoler of maids, said Gareth. We could take any of the maids or cook.
They would not come.
We could take the kitchen maid. We could make her come. And then, when we have caught the unicorn which is wanted, we will bring it home in triumph and give it to our mother. We will serve at supper every night. She will be pleased. Perhaps after supper, whatever the event. And Sir Grummor will knight us. He will say, Never has such a doughty deed been done by my Halidome.
St. Tordelbach laid the precious book on the grass outside his hole. The grass was sandy and had empty snail shells scattered over it, small yellowish shells with a purple spiral. He opened the book, which was a bestiary, called Liber de Natura Quarundum Animalium, and showed that it had pictures on every page. They made him turn the vellum quickly, with its lovely Gothic manuscript, skipping the enchanting griffins, bonacons, cocodrills, manticores, chaladrii, cynomolgi, sirens, peridexians, dragons, and aspidocolones. In vain for their eager glances did the antelope rub its complicated horns against the tamarisk tree, thus entangled, becoming a prey to its hunters. In vain did the bonacon emit its flatulence in order to baffle the pursuers. The peridexians, sitting on trees which made them immune to dragons, sat unnoticed. The panther blew out his fragrant breath, which attracted his prey, without interest for them. The tigress, who could be deceived by throwing down a glass ball at its feet, in which, seeing its reflection, it thought to see its own cubs. The lion, who spared prostrate men or captives, was afraid of white cocks and brushed out his own tracks with a foliated tail. The ibex, who could bound down from mountains unharmed because he bounced upon his curly horns. The yale, who could move his horns like ears. The she-bear, who was accustomed to bear her young as lumps of matter and lick them into whatever shape she fancied afterwards. The caladrius bird, who, if facing you when it sat on your bedrail, showed that you were going to die. The hedgehogs, who collected grapes for their progeny by rolling on them, and brought them back on the end of their prickles. Even the aspidocolone, who was a large whale-like creature with seven fins and a sheepish expression, to whom you were liable to moor your boat in mistake for an island if you were not careful, even the aspidocolone scarcely detained them. At last he found them the place at the unicorn, called by the Greek rhinoceros. It seemed that the unicorn was as swift and timid as the antelope, and could only be captured in one way. You had to have a maid for bait, and when the unicorn perceived her alone, he would immediately come to lay his horn in her lap. There was a picture of an unreliable-looking virgin, holding the poor creature's horn in one hand, while she beckoned to some spearmen with the other. Her expression of duplicity was balanced by the fatuous confidence with which the unicorn regarded her. Gawain hurried off as soon as the instructions had been read and the picture digested to fetch the kitchen-maid without delay.
"Now then," he said, "you have to come with us on the mountain to catch a unicorn."
"Oh, Master Gawain," cried the maid he had caught hold of, whose name was Meg.
"Yes, you have. You're to be the bait, whatever. It will come and put its head in your lap."
Meg began to weep.
"Now then, do not be silly."
"Oh, Master Gawain, I do not want a unicorn. I've been a decent girl, I have, and there is all the washing up to do, and if Mistress True Love to catch me playing at truant, I shall get stick, Master Gawain, that I will."
He took her firmly by the plaits and led her out. In the clean bog wind of the high tops, they discussed the hunt. Meg, who cried incessantly, was held by the hair to prevent her from running away, and occasionally passed from one boy to the other if the one who was holding her happened to want both hands for gestures.
"Now then," said Gawain, "I am the captain. I am the oldest, so I am the captain."
"I thought of it," said Gareth. "The question is, it says in the book that the bait must be left alone. She will run away. Will you run away, Meg?"
"Yes, please, Master Gawain."
"There.
Then she must be tied."
"Oh, Master Gaheris, if it is your will, need I be tied?"
"Close your mouth, you're only a girl. There is nothing to tie her with."
"I am the captain, my heroes, and I command that Gareth runs back home to fetch some rope."
"That I will not."
"But you will destroy everything if you do not do so. I do not see why I should have to go. I thought of it."
"Then I command our Agravain to go."
"Not I."
"Let Caheris go."
"I will not." "Meg, you wicked girl, you're not to run away, do you hear?"
"Yes, Master Gawain, but oh, Master Gawain."
"If we could find a strong heather root," said Agravain, "we could tie her pigtails together round the other side of it."
"We will do that."
"Oh!"
After they had secured the virgin, the four boys stood round her discussing the next stage. They had abstracted real boar spears from the armoury, so they were properly armed.
"This girl," said Agravain, "is my mother. This is what our mammy was doing yesterday, and I am going to be Sir Grummor."
"I will be Pellinore."
"Agravain can be Grummor if he wants to be, but the bait has got to be left alone. It says so in the book."
"Oh, Master Gawain, oh, Master Agravain."
"Stop howling. You will frighten the unicorn."
"And then we must go away and hide. That is why our mother did not catch it, because the knight stayed with her."
"I'm going to be Finn McCool.
I shall be Sir Palomides.
Oh, Master Gawain, pray do not leave me alone.
Hold in your noise, said Gawain. You are silly. You ought to be proud to be the bait. Our mother was yesterday.
Gareth said,
Never mind, Meg. Do not cry. We will not let it hurt you.
After all, it can only kill you, said Agravaine brutally.
At this, the unfortunate girl began to weep more than ever.
Why did you say that? Asked Gawain angrily. You always try to frighten people. Now she is at howling more than before.
Look, said Gareth. Look, Meg. Poor Meg. Do not cry. It'll be with me to let you have some shots with my catapult when we go home.
Oh, Master Gareth.
Ach, come your ways. We cannot bother with her.
There, there.
Meg, said Gawain, making a frightful face, if you do not stop squealing, I will look at you like this. She dried her tears at once. Now, he said, when the unicorn comes, we must all rush out and stick it. Do you understand?
Must it be killed?
Yes, it must be killed dead.
I see. I hope it will not hurt it, said Gareth.
That is the sort of foolish hope you would have, said Agravaine.
But I do not see why it should be killed.
So that we may take it home to our mother, you Amadon.
Could we catch it, asked Gareth, and lead it to our mother, do you think? I mean, we could get Meg to lead it if it was tame.
Gawain and Gaheris agreed to this.
If it is tame, they said, it would be better to bring it back alive. That is the best kind of big game hunting.
We could drive it, said Agravaine. We could hit it along with sticks. We could hit Meg too, he added as an afterthought.
Then they hid themselves in their ambush and decided to keep silence. There was nothing to be heard except the gentle wind, the heather bees, the skylarks very high, and a few distant snuffles from Meg. When the unicorn came, things were different from what had been expected. He was such a noble animal to begin with that he carried a beauty with him. It held all spellbound who were within sight. The unicorn was white, with hoofs of silver and a graceful horn of pearl. He stepped daintily over the heather, scarcely seeming to press it with his airy trot, and the wind made waves in his long mane, which had been freshly combed. The glorious thing about him was his eye. There was a faint bluish furrow down each side of his nose, and this led up to the eye sockets and surrounded them in a pensive shade. The eyes, circled by this sad and beautiful darkness, were so sorrowful, lonely, gentle, and nobly tragic that they killed all other emotion except love. The unicorn went up to Meg, the kitchen-maid, and bowed his head in front of her. He arched his neck beautifully to do this, and the pearl horn pointed to the ground at her feet, and he scratched in the heather with his silver hoof to make a salute. Meg had forgotten her tears. She made a royal gesture of acknowledgement and held her hand out to the animal.
Come, unicorn, she said. Lay your head in my lap, if you like.
The unicorn made a whinny and pawed again with his hoof. Then, very carefully, he went down first on one knee and then on the other till he was bowing in front of her. He looked up at her from this position with his melting eyes and at last laid his head upon her knee. He stroked his flat, white cheek against the smoothness of her dress, looking at her beseechingly. The whites of his eyes rolled with an upward flash. He settled his hind quarters coyly and lay still, looking up. His eyes brimmed with trustfulness, and he lifted his near fore in a gesture of pawing. It was a movement in the air only, which said, Now attend to me. Give me some love. Stroke my mane, will you please? There was a choking noise from Agravain in the ambush, and at once he was rushing toward the unicorn with the sharp boar spear in his hands. The other boys squatted upright on their heels, watching him. Agravain came to the unicorn and began jabbing his spear into its quarters, into its slim belly, into its ribs. He squealed as he jabbed, and the unicorn looked to Meg in anguish. It leapt and moved suddenly, still looking at her reproachfully, and Meg took its horn in one hand. She seemed entranced, unable to help it. The unicorn did not seem able to move from the soft grip of her hand on its horn. The blood, caused by Agravain's spear, spurted out upon the blue-white coat of hair. Gareth began running, with Gawain close after him. Gaheris came last, stupid and not knowing what to do.
"Don't!" cried Gareth. "Leave him alone! Don't! Don't!"
Gawain came up just as Agravain's spear went in under the fifth rib. The unicorn shuddered. He trembled in all his body and stretched his hind legs out behind. They went out almost straight as if he were doing his greatest leap, and then quivered, trembling in the agony of death. All the time his eyes were fixed on Meg's eyes, and she still looked down at his.
"What are you doing?" shouted Gawain. "Leave him alone! No harm at him!"
"Oh, unicorn," whispered Meg.
The unicorn's legs stretched out horizontally behind him and stopped trembling. His head dropped in Meg's lap. After a last kick, they became rigid, and the blue lids rose half over the eye. The creature lay still.
"What have you done?" said Gareth. "You have killed him. He was beautiful."
Agravain bawled,
"This girl is my mother. He put his head in her lap. He had to die."
"We said we would keep him," yelled Gawain. "We said we would take him home and be allowed to supper."
"Poor unicorn," said Meg.
"Look," said Gaheris. "I'm afraid he's dead."
Gareth stood square in front of Agravain, who was 3 years older than he was, and could have knocked him down quite easily.
"Why did you do it?" he demanded. "You're a murderer. It was a lovely unicorn. Why did you kill it?"
"His head was in our mother's lap. It did not mean any harm. Its hooves were silver."
"It was a unicorn, and it had to be killed. I ought to have killed Meg, too."
"You are a traitor," said Gawain. "We could have taken it home and been allowed to serve at supper."
"Anyway," said Gaheris, "now it is dead." Meg bowed her head over the unicorn's forelock of white and once again began to sob. Gareth began stroking the head. He had to turn away to hide his tears. By stroking it, he had found out how smooth and soft its coat was. He had seen a near view of its eye, now quickly fading, and this had brought the tragedy home to him.
"Well, it is dead now, whatever," said Gaheris for the third time. "We'd better take it home."
"We managed to catch one," said Gawain,
the wonder of their achievement beginning to dawn on him.
"It was a brute," said Agravain.
"We caught it! We, of ourselves!
Sir Grammor did not catch one, but we did!"
Gawain had forgotten about his sorrow for the unicorn. He began to dance round the body, waving his boar spear and uttering horrible shrieks.
"We must have a gralloch," said Gaheris. "We must do the matter properly, and cut its insides out and sling it over a pony and take it home to the castle like proper hunters. And then she will be pleased. She will say, 'God's feet, but my sons are of mickle might.' We shall be allowed to be like Sir Grammor and King Pellinore. Everything will go well with us from now. How must we set about the gralloch?" "We cut out its guts," said Agravain.
Gareth got up and began to go into the heather. He said,
"I do not want to help cut him. Do you, Meg?"
Meg, who was feeling ill inside herself, made no answer. Gareth untied her hair.
and suddenly she was off, running for all she was worth away from the tragedy toward the castle. Gareth ran after her.
"Meg! Meg!" he called. "Wait for me! Do not run!"
But Meg continued to run, as swiftly as an antelope, with her bare feet twinkling behind her, and Gareth gave it up. He flung himself down in the heather and began to cry in earnest. He did not know why. At the Gralach, the three remaining huntsmen were in trouble. They had begun to slit at the skin of the belly, but they did not know how to do it properly, and so they had perforated the intestines. Everything had begun to be horrible, and the once beautiful animal was spoiled and repulsive. All three of them loved the unicorn in various ways, Agravain in the most twisted one, and in proportion as they became responsible for spoiling its beauty, so they began to hate it for their guilt. Gawain, in particular, began to hate the body. He hated it for being dead, for having been beautiful, for making him feel a beast. He had loved it and helped to trap it, so now there was nothing to be done except to vent his shame and hatred of himself upon the corpse. He hacked and cut and felt like crying too.
"We shall not ever get it done," they panted. "How can we ever carry it down, even if we manage the Gralach?"
"But we must," said Geharis. "We must. If we do not, what will be the good? We must take it home."
"We cannot carry it. We have not a pony."
"At a Gralach, they sling the beast over a pony."
"We must cut its head off," said Agravain. "We must cut its head off somehow and carry that. It would be enough if we took the head. We could carry it between us."
So they set to work, hating their work, at the horrid business of hacking through its neck. Gareth stopped crying in the heather. He rolled over on his back, and immediately he was looking straight into the sky. The clouds, which were sailing majestically across its endless depth, made him feel giddy. He thought, "How far is it to that cloud? 1 mile? And the one above it? 2 miles? And beyond that, 1 mile and 1 mile, and 1,000,000,000 miles, all in the empty blue. Perhaps I will fall off the earth now, supposing the earth is upside down, and then I shall go sailing and sailing away. I shall try to catch hold of the clouds as I pass them, but they will not stop me. Where shall I go?"
This thought made Gareth feel sick, and as he was also feeling ashamed of himself for running away from the Gralach, he became uncomfortable all over. In these circumstances, the only thing to do was to abandon the place in which he was feeling uncomfortable, in the hope of leaving his discomfort behind him. He got up and went back to the others.
"Hello," said Gawain. "Did you catch her?"
"No, she escaped away to the castle."
"I hope she will not tell anybody," said Geharis. "It has to be a surprise, or it is no good for us."
The three butchers were daubed with sweat and blood, and they were absolutely miserable. Agravain had been sick twice. Yet they continued in their labour, and Gareth helped them.
"It's no good stopping now," said Gawain. "Think how good it'll be if we can take it to our mother. She will probably come upstairs to say good night to us if we can take her what she needs. She will laugh and say we are mighty hunters."
When the grisly spine was severed, the head was too heavy to carry. They got themselves in a mess trying to lift it. Then Gawain suggested that it had better be dragged with a rope. There was none.
"We could drag it by the horn," said Gareth. "At any rate, we could drag and push it like that, so long as it was downhill."
Only one of them at a time could get a good hold of the horn, so they took it in turns to do the hauling, while the others pushed behind when the head got snagged in a heather root or a drain. It was heavy for them even in this way, so that they had to stop every 20 yards or so to change over.
"When we get to the castle," panted Gawain, "we will prop it up in the seat in the garden. Our mother is bound to walk past there when she goes for her walk before supper. Then we will stand in front of it until she is ready, and all will suddenly step back at once, and there it will be.
She will be surprised, said Gaheris.
When they had at last got it down from the sloping ground, there was another hitch. They found that it was no longer possible to drag it on the flat land, because the horn did not give enough purchase. In this emergency, for it was getting near to supper time, Gareth voluntarily ran ahead to fetch a rope. A rope was tied round what remained of the head, and thus, at last, with eyes ruined, flesh bruised and separating from the bones, the muddy, bloody, heather-mangled exhibit was conveyed on its last stage to the herb garden. They heaved it to the seat and arranged its mane as well as they could. Gareth particularly tried to prop it up so that it would give a little idea of the beauty which he remembered. The magic queen came punctually on her walk, conversing with Sir Grummor, and followed by her lapdogs, Tray, Blanche, and Sweetheart. She did not notice her four sons, lined up in front of the seat. They stood respectfully in a row, dirty, excited, their breasts beating with hope.
"Now!" cried Gawain, and they stood aside.
Queen Morgause did not see the unicorn. Her mind was busy with other things. With Sir Grummor she passed by.
"Mother!"
cried Gareth in a strange voice, and he ran after her, plucking at her skirt.
"Yes, my white one. What do you want?"
"Oh, mother, we've got you a unicorn."
"How amusing they are, Sir Grummor," she said. "Well, my doves, you must run along and ask for your milk."
"But, Mammy!"
"Yes, yes," she said in a low voice. "Another time."
And the queen passed on, with the puzzled knight of the forest sauvage, electrical and quiet. She had not noticed that her children's clothes were ruined, had not even scolded them about that. When she found out about the unicorn later in the evening, she had them whipped for it, for she had spent an unsuccessful day with the English knights. Chapter 8. The plain of Bedegraine was a forest of pavilions. They looked like old-fashioned bathing tents, and were every colour of the rainbow. Some of them were even striped like bathing tents, but for the most part they were in plain colours, yellow and green and so on. There were heraldic devices worked or stamped on the sides, enormous black eagles with two heads perhaps, or wyverns, or lances, or oak trees, or punning signs which referred to the names of the owners. For instance, Sir Kay had a black key on his tent, and Sir Ulbors, in the opposing camp, had a couple of elbows in flowing sleeves. The proper name for them would be manchets. Then there were pennons floating from the tops of the tents, and sheaves of spears leaning against them. The more sporting barons had shields or huge copper basins outside their front doors, and all you had to do was to give a thump on one of these with the butt end of your spear for the baron to come out like an angry bee and have a fight with you almost before the resounding boom had died away. Sir Dinadane, who was a cheerful man, had hung a chamber pot outside his. Then there were the people themselves. All round and about the tents there were cooks quarrelling with dogs who had eaten the mutton, and small pages writing insults on each other's backs when they were not looking, and elegant minstrels with lutes singing tunes similar to Greensleeves, with soulful expressions, and squires with a world of innocence in their eyes trying to sell each other spavined horses, and hurdy-gurdy men trying to earn a groat by playing on the viol, and gypsies telling your fortune for the battle, and enormous knights with their heads wrapped in untidy turbans, playing chess, and vivandières sitting on the knees of some of them, and as for entertainment,
There were joculators, gleemen, tumblers, harpers, troubadours, jesters, minstrels, tregetors, bear dancers, egg dancers, ladder dancers, ballet dancers, mountebanks, fire eaters, and balancers. In a way, it was like Derby Day. The tremendous forest of Sherwood stretched round the tent forest further than the eye could see, and this was full of wild boars, warrantable stags, outlaws, dragons, and purple emperors. There was also an ambush in the forest, but nobody was supposed to know about that. King Arthur paid no attention to the coming battle. He sat invisible in his pavilion at the hub of the excitement, and talked to Sir Ector or Kay or Merlin day after day. The smaller captains were delighted to think that their king was having so many councils of war, for they could see the lamp burning inside the silk tent until all hours, and they felt sure that he was inventing a splendid plan of campaign. Actually, the conversation was about different things. "There will be a lot of jealousy," said Kay. "You will have all these knights in this order of yours saying that they are the best one and wanting to sit at the top of the table."
"Then we must have a round table, with no top."
"But, Arthur, you could never sit 150 knights at a round table. Let me see."
Merlin, who hardly ever interfered in the arguments now, but sat with his hands folded on his stomach and beamed, helped Kay out of the difficulty.
"It would need to be about 50 yards across," he said. "You do it by 2 pi-r."
"Well, then, say it was 50 yards across. Think of all the space in the middle. It would be an ocean of wood with a thin rim of humanity. You couldn't keep the food in the middle even, because nobody would be able to reach it."
"Then we can have a circular table," said Arthur, "not a round one. I don't know what the proper word is. I mean, we could have a table shaped like the rim of a cartwheel, and the servants could walk about in the empty space where the spokes would be. We could call them the Knights of the Round Table."
"What a good name."
"And the important thing," continued the king, who was getting wiser the more he thought, "the most important thing will be to catch them young. The old knights, the ones we're fighting against, will mostly be too old to learn. I think we shall be able to get them in and keep them fighting the right way, but they will be inclined to stick to the old habits, like Sir Bruce. Grummor and Pellinore, we must have them, of course. I wonder where they are now. Grummor and Pellinore will be all right, because they were always kindly in themselves. But I don't think Lot's people will ever really be at home with it. That's why I say we must catch them young. We must breed up a new generation of chivalry for the future. That child Lancelot who came over with you-know-who, for instance, we must get hold of kids like him. They will be the real table."
"Apropos of this table," said Merlin, "I don't see why I should not tell you that King Leodegrance has one which would do very well. As you are going to marry his daughter, he might be persuaded to give you the table as a wedding present."
"Am I going to marry his daughter?"
"Certainly. She is called Guinevere."
"Look, Merlin, I don't like knowing about the future, and I'm not sure whether I believe in it."
"There are some things," said the magician, "which I have to tell you, whether you believe them or not. The trouble is, I can't help feeling there is one thing which I've forgotten to tell. Remind me to warn you about Guinevere another time."
"It confuses everybody," said Arthur complainingly. "I get muddled up with half the questions I want to ask you myself. For instance, who was my—"
"You will have to have special feasts," interrupted Kay, "at Pentecost and so on, when all the knights come to dinner and say what they have done. It will make them want to fight in this new way of yours, if they're going to recite about it afterwards. And Merlin could write their names in their places by magic, and their coat armour could be engraved over their sieges. It would be grand." This exciting idea made the king forget his question, and the two young men sat down immediately to draw their own blazons for the magician, so that there should be no mistake about the tinctures.
While they were in the middle of the drawing, Kay looked up with his tongue between his teeth and remarked, "By the way,
You remember that argument we were having about aggression? Well, I've thought of a good reason for starting a war.
Merlin froze.
I would like to hear it.
A good reason for starting a war is simply to have a good reason. For instance, there might be a king who had discovered a new way of life for human beings. You know, something which would be good for them. It might even be the only way of saving them from destruction. Well, if the human beings were too wicked or too stupid to accept his way, he might have to force it on them, in their own interests, by the sword.
The magician clenched his fists, twisted his gown into screws, and began to shake all over.
Very interesting, he said in a trembling voice. Very interesting. There was just such a man when I was young, an Austrian who invented a new way of life and convinced himself that he was the chap to make it work. He tried to impose his reformation by the sword and plunged the civilized world into misery and chaos. But the thing which this fellow had overlooked, my friend, was that he had a predecessor in the reformation business called Jesus Christ. Perhaps we may assume that Jesus knew as much as the Austrian did about saving people. But the odd thing is that Jesus did not turn the disciples into stormtroopers, burn down the Temple of Jerusalem, and fix the blame on Pontius Pilate. On the contrary, he made it clear that the business of the philosophers was to make ideas available, and not to impose them on people.
Kay looked pale but obstinate. Arthur is fighting the present war, he said, to impose his ideas on King Lot. Chapter 9. The Queen's suggestion about hunting unicorns had a curious result. The more lovelorn King Pellinore became, the more obvious it was that something would have to be done. Sir Palomides had an inspiration.
The royal melancholy, said he, can only be dispelled by questing beast. This is the subject to which the Maharaja Sahib has been accustomed by lifelong habit. Yours truly has said so all along. Personally, said Grammore, I believe the questing beast is dead. Anyway, it is in Flanders. Then we must dress up, said Sir Palomides. We must assume the role of questing beast and be hunted ourselves. We could scarcely dress as the beast.
But the Saracen had run away with the idea.
Why not? He asked. Why not, by jingo? Joculators assume garb of animals, as stags, goats, and so forth, and dance to bells and tabor with many gyrings and circumflections. But really, Palomides, we are not joculators. Then we must learn to be so. Joculators?
A joculator was a juggler, a low kind of minstrel, and Sir Grammore did not relish the idea at all.
However could we dress as the questing beast? He asked weakly. She is a frightfully complicated animal. Describe this animal. Well, dash it all. She has a snake's head and the body of a leopard, and haunches like a lion and feet like a hart. And hang it, man, how could we make this noise in her belly like 30 couple of hounds questing? Yours truly will be the belly, replied Sir Palomides, and will give tongue as follows.
He began yodeling.
Hush, cried Sir Grammore, you'll wake the castle. Then it is agreed? No, it is not agreed. Never heard such nonsense in me life. Besides, she don't make a noise like that. She makes a noise like this.
And Sir Grammore began cackling in a tuneless alto, like thousands of wild geese on the wash.
Hush, hush, cried Sir Palomides. I won't hush. The noise you was making was like pigs.
The two naturalists began hooting, grunting, squawking, squealing, crowing, mooing, growling, snuffling, quacking, snarling, and mewing at one another until they were red in the face.
The head,
said Sir Grummor, stopping suddenly, "will have to be of cardboard."
"Or canvas," said Sir Palomides. "The fishing populace will be in possession of canvas. We can make leather boots for hoofs. Spots can be painted on the body. It will have to button round the middle, where we join. And you," added Sir Palomides generously, "can be the back end and do hounds. The noise is plainly stated to come from the belly."
Sir Grummor blushed with pleasure and said gruffly in his Norman way,
"Well, thanks, Palomides. I must say, I think that's damned decent of you."
"Not at all."
For a week, King Pellinore saw hardly anything of his friends. "You write poems, Pellinore," they told him, "or go and sigh on the cliffs. There's a good fellow." He wandered about, occasionally crying out,
"Flanders, Glanders," or "Daughter, Orta,"
whenever the ideas occurred to him, while the Dark Queen hung in the background. Meanwhile, in Sir Palomides' room, where the door was kept locked, there was such a stitching and snipping and painting and arguing as had seldom been known before.
"My dear chap, I tell you a libbard has black spots."
"Puce,"
Sir Palomides said obstinately.
"What is puce? And anyway, we have not got any."
They glared at each other with the fury of creators.
"Try on the head. There, you've torn it. I said you would. Construction was of feeble nature. We must construct the thing again."
When the reconstruction was finished, the Paynim stood back to admire it.
"Look out for the spots, Palomides. There, you've smudged them."
"A thousand pardons. You ought to look where you're going. Well, who put his foot through the ribs?"
On the second day, there was trouble with the back end.
"These haunches are too tight."
"Don't bend over."
"I have to bend over if I am the back end."
"They won't split."
"Yes, they will."
"No, they won't."
"Well, they have. Look out for my tail,"
said Sir Grummor on the third day.
"You're treading on it."
"Don't hold so tight, Grummor. My neck is twisted."
"Can't you see?"
"No, I can't. My neck is twisted."
"There goes my tail."
There was a pause while they sorted themselves out.
"Now, carefully this time. We must walk in step."
"You give the step."
"Left, right, left, right.
I think my haunches are coming down."
"If you let go of yours truly's waist, we shall come in half."
"Well, I can't hold up my haunches unless I do."
"There go the buttons."
"Damn the buttons.
Yours truly told you so."
So they sewed on buttons during the fourth day and started again.
"Can I practice my baying now?"
"Yes, indeed."
"How does my baying sound from inside?"
"It sounds splendid, Grummor, splendid. Only it is strange in a way, coming from behind, if you follow my argument."
"I thought it sounded muffled."
"It did, a bit."
"Perhaps it will be all right from outside."
On the fifth day, they were far advanced.
"We ought to practice a gallop. After all, we can't walk all the time, not when he's hunting us."
"Very good."
"When I say go, then, go. Ready, steady, go."
"Look out, Grummor, you are butting me."
"Butting?
Be careful of the bed."
"What did you say?"
"Oh, dear."
"Confound the bed to blazes. Oh, my shins."
"You have burst the buttons again."
"Damn the buttons. I've stubbed my toe."
"Well, yours truly's head has come off also."
"We shall have to stick to walking."
"It would be easier to gallop," said Sir Grummor on the sixth day, "if we had some music. Something like Tantivy, you know."
"Well, we have not got any music."
"No." "Could you sing out Tantivy, Palomides, while I am baying?"
"Yours truly could try."
"Very well, then. Off we go.
Tantivy, Tantivy, Tantivy!
Damn!
We shall have to make the whole thing again, said Sir Palomides over the weekend. We can still use the hoofs. I don't suppose it will hurt so much falling down out of doors, not on the moss, you know. And probably it won't tear the canvas so badly.
We will make it double strength.
Yes.
I'm glad the hoofs will still do. By Jove, Palomides! Don't he look a monster? A splendid effort this time. Pity you can't make fire come out of his mouth or something. A danger of combustion there. Shall we try another gallop, Palomides? By all means. Push the bed in the corner, then.
Look out for the buttons.
If you see anything we're running into, just stop, see?
Yes.
Keep a sharp lookout, Palomides.
Right-ho, Grummer.
Ready, then?
Ready. Off we go.
That was a splendid burst, Palomides, exclaimed the Knight of the Forest Sauvage.
A noble gallop.
Did you notice how I was baying all the time?
I could not fail to notice it, Sir Grummer.
Well, well, I don't know when I've enjoyed myself so much.
They panted with triumph, standing amid their monster.
I say, Palomides, look at me swishing my tail.
Charming, Sir Grummer. Look at me winking one of my eyes.
No, no, Palomides, you look at my tail. You ought not to miss it, really.
Well, if I look at you swishing, you ought to look at me winking. That is only fair.
But I can't see anything from inside.
As for that, Sir Grummer, yours truly can't see so far round as the anal appendage.
Now then, we will have one last go. I shall swish my tail round and round all the time and bay like mad. It will be a frightful spectacle.
And yours truly will continuously wink one optic or the other.
Could we put a bit of a bound into the gallop, Palomides, every now and then, do you think? You know, a kind of prance?
The prance could more naturally be affected by the back end solo.
You mean I could do it alone?
Effectually.
Well, I must say that is uncommonly decent of you, Palomides, to let me do the prancing.
Yours truly trusts that a modicum of caution will be exercised in the prance to prevent delivery of uncomfortable blows to the posterior of the forequarters.
Just as you say, Palomides.
Boot and saddle, Sir Grummer.
Tally-ho, Sir Palomides.
Tantivy, 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 a questing we will go.
The Queen had recognized the impossible. Even in the miasma of her Gaelic mind, she had come to see that asses do not mate with pythons. It was useless to go on dramatizing her charms and talents for the benefit of these ridiculous knights, useless to go on hunting them with the tyrannous baits of what she thought was love. With a sudden turn of feeling, she discovered that she hated them. They were imbeciles, as well as being the Sassenach, and she herself was a saint. She was, she discovered with a change of posture, interested in nothing but her darling boys. She was the best mother to them in the world. Her heart ached for them, her maternal bosom swelled. When Gareth nervously brought White Heather to her bedroom as an apology for being whipped, she covered him with kisses, glancing in the mirror. He escaped from the embrace and dried his tears, partly uncomfortable, partly in rapture. The heather which he had brought was set up dramatically in a cup with no water. She was every inch the homebody, and he was free to go. He scampered from the royal chamber with the news of forgiveness, went spinning down the circular stairs like a teetotum. It was a different castle to the one in which King Arthur used to scamper, A Norman would hardly have recognized it as a castle, except for the Peel Tower. It was 1,000 years more ancient than anything the Normans knew. This castle, through which the child was running to bring the good news of their mother's love to his brothers, had begun in the mists of the past as that strange symbol of the old ones, a promontory fort. Driven to the sea by the volcano of history, they had turned at bay on the last peninsula. With the sea literally at their backs, on a cliffy tongue of land, they had built their single wall across the root of the tongue. The sea, which was their doom, had also been their last defender on every other side. There, on the promontory, the blue-painted cannibals had piled up their cyclopean wall of unmortared stones, 14 feet high and equally thick, with terraces on the inside from which they could hurl their flints. All along the outside of the wall, they had embedded thousands of sharp stones in the scraw, each stone pointing outward in a cheval de frise, which was like a petrified hedgehog. Behind it, and behind the enormous wall, they had huddled at night in wooden shacks, together with their domestic animals. There had been heads of enemies erected on poles for decoration, and their king had built himself an underground treasure chamber, which was also a subterranean passage for escape. It had led under the wall, so that even if the fort was stormed, he could creep out behind the attackers. It had been a passage along which only one man could crawl at a time, and it had been constructed with a special kink in it, at which he could wait to knock a pursuer on the head as the latter negotiated the obstacle. The diggers of the souterrain had been executed by their own priest-king to keep the secret of it. All that was in an earlier millennium. Dunlothian had grown with the slow conservancy of the old ones. Here, with a Scandinavian conquest, had sprung up a wooden longhouse. There, the original stones of the curtain wall had been pulled down to build a round tower for priests. The Peel Tower, with a cow byre under the two living chambers, had come the last of all. So it was among the untidy wreckage of centuries that Gareth scampered, looking for his brothers. It was among lean-tos and adaptations, past Ogham stones commemorating some long-dead Diag, the son of No, built into a later bastion upside down. It was on the top of a wind-swept cliff, purged to the bone by the airs of the Atlantic, under which the little fishing village nestled among the dunes. It was as the inheritor of a view which covered 12 miles of rollers and hundreds of miles of cumulus. All along the coastline, the saints and scholars of Eru inhabited their stone igloos in holy horribleness, reciting 50 psalms in their beehives, and 50 in the open air, and 50 with their bodies plunged in cold water, in their loathing for the twinkling world. St. Turtlebach was far from typical of their species. Gareth found his brother in the storeroom. It smelt of oatmeal, ham, smoked salmon, dried cod, onions, shark oil, pickled herrings in tubs, hemp, maize, hen's fluff, sailcloth, milk, the butter was churned there on Thursdays, seasoning pine wood, apples, herbs drying, fish glue and varnish used by the Fletcher, spices from overseas, dead rat in trap, venison, seaweed, wood shavings, litter of kittens, fleeces from the mountain sheep not yet sold, and the pungent smell of tar. Gawain, Agravain, and Gaheris were sitting on the fleeces eating apples. They were in the middle of an argument. "It is not our business," said Gawain stubbornly. Agravain whined, "But it is our business. It is at us more than anybody, and it is not right."
"How dare you to say that our mother is not right?"
"She is not."
"She is. If you can but contradict..."
"They're decent for the Sassenach," said Gawain. "Sir Grummor let me try his helm last night."
"That has nothing to do with it." Gawain said, "I'm not wishing to talk about it. It is base to be talking. Pure Gawain."
As Gareth came in, he could see Gawain's face flaming at Agravain under his red hair. It was obvious that he was going to have one of his rages, but Agravain was one of those luckless intellectuals who are too proud to give in to brute force. He was the kind who gets knocked down in an argument because he cannot defend himself, but continues the argument on the floor, sneering, "Go on then, hit me again to show how clever you are." Gawain glared at him.
"Silence your mouth."
"I will not."
"I will make you."
"If you will make me or not, it will be the same." Gareth said, "Be quiet, Agravain. Gawain, leave him alone. Agravain, if you do not be quiet, he will kill you."
"I do not care if he does kill me. What I say is true."
"Hold your noise."
"I will not." "I say we ought to indite a letter to our father about these knights. We ought to tell him about our mother. We ought—"
Gawain was upon him before he could finish the sentence.
"Your soul to the devil," he shouted. "Traitor! Ah, so you would."
For Agravain had done something unprecedented in the family troubles. He was the weaker of the two, and he was afraid of pain. As he went down, he had drawn his dirk upon his brother.
"Look to his arm!" cried Gareth. The two were going over and over among the rolled fleeces.
"Gaheris, catch his hand! Gawain, leave him alone! Agravain, drop it! Agravain, if you do not drop it, he will kill you! Ah, you brute!"
The boy's face was blue, and the dirk nowhere to be seen. Gawain, with his hands round Agravain's throat, was ferociously beating his head on the floor. Gareth took hold of Gawain's shirt at the neck and twisted it to choke him. Gaheris, hovering round the edge, ferreted for the dirk.
"Leave me," panted Gawain. "Let me be."
He gave a coughing or husky note in his chest, like a young lion making its roar. Agravain, whose Adam's apple had been hurt, relaxed his muscles and lay hiccuping with his eyes shut. He looked as if he were going to die. They dragged Gawain off and held him down, still struggling to get at his victim and finish the work. It was curious that when he was in one of these black passions, he seemed to pass out of human life. In later days, he even killed women when he had been worked into such a state, though he regretted it bitterly afterwards. When the counterfeit beast was perfected, the knights took it away and hid it in a cave at the foot of the cliffs, above high water mark. Then they had some whisky to celebrate, and set off in search of the king as darkness fell. They found him in his chamber with a quill pen and a sheet of parchment. There was no poetry on the parchment, only a picture which was intended to be a heart transfixed by an arrow, with two peas drawn inside it, interlaced. The king was blowing his nose.
"Excuse me, Pellinore," said Sir Grummore, "but we have seen something on the cliffs."
"Something nasty?"
"Well, not exactly."
"I hoped it would be."
Sir Grummore thought the situation over and drew the Saracen aside. They decided that tact was needed.
"Oh, Pellinore," said Sir Grummore nonchalantly, "what is this that you are drawing?"
"What do you think it is?"
"It looks like a sort of drawing."
"That is what it is," said the king. "I wish you two would go away. I mean, if you could take a hint."
"It would be better if you were to make a line here," pursued Sir Grummore.
"Where?"
"Here, where the pig is."
"My dear fellow, I don't know what you're talking about."
"I'm sorry, Pellinore. I thought you was drawing a pig with your eyes shut."
Sir Palomides thought it was time to interfere.
"Sir Grummore," he said coyly, "has observed a phenomenon, by Jove."
"A phenomenon?"
"A thing," explained Sir Grummore.
"What sort of thing?" asked the king suspiciously.
"Something you will like." "It has four legs," added the Saracen.
"Is it animal?" asked the king. "Vegetable or mineral?"
"Animal."
"A pig?"
inquired the king, who was beginning to feel they must be driving at something.
"No, no, Pellinore, not a pig. Get pigs out of your head right away.
This thing makes a noise like hounds. Like 60 hounds, explained Sir Palomides.
It is a whale, cried the king.
No, no, Pellinore, a whale has no legs.
But it makes such a noise.
Does a whale?
My dear fellow, how am I to know? You must try to keep the issue clear.
I see, but what is the issue, what? It seems to be a menagerie game.
No, no, Pellinore, it is something we have seen, which bays.
Oh, I say, he wailed, I do wish you two would either shut up or go away. What with whales and pigs, and now this thing which bays, a fellow does not know where he is half the time. Can't you leave a fellow alone to draw his little things and hang himself quietly for once? I mean to say, it is not much to ask, is it, what? Don't you know?
Pellinore, said Sir Grummore, you must pull yourself together. We have seen the questing beast.
Why?
Why?
Yes, why?
Why do you say why? I mean, explained Sir Grummore, you could say where or when, but why?
Why not?
Pellinore, have you lost all sense of decency? We have seen the questing beast, I tell you. Seen it on the cliffs here, quite close.
It is not an it. It is a she.
My dear chap, it doesn't matter what she is. We have seen her.
Then why don't you go and catch her?
It is not for us to catch her, Pellinore. It is for you. After all, she is your life's work, isn't she?
She's stupid, said the king.
She may be stupid, or she may not, said Sir Grummore in an offended tone. The point is, she is your magnum opus. Only a Pellinore can catch her. You have told us so often.
What is the point of catching her? Asked the monarch. What? After all, she is probably quite happy on the cliffs. I don't see what you are fussing about. It seems dreadfully sad, he added at a tangent, that people can't be married when they want to. I mean, what is the good of this animal to me? I have not married it, have I? So why am I chasing it all the time? It doesn't seem logical.
What you want, Pellinore, is a good hunt. Shake up your liver.
They took away his pen and poured him several bumpers of usquebaugh, not forgetting to take a nip or two themselves.
It seems the only thing to do, he said suddenly. After all, only a Pellinore can catch it.
That's the brave fellow.
Only I do feel sad sometimes, he added before they could stop him, about the Queen of Flanders' daughter. She was not beautiful, Grummore, but she understood me. We seemed to get on together, if you see what I mean. I am'n't clever, perhaps, and I may get into trouble when I am by myself, but when I was with Piggy, she always knew what to do. It was company, too. It is not bad to have a bit of company when you're getting on in life, especially when you've been chasing the questing beast all the time, what? It gets a bit lonely in the forest. Not that the questing beast wasn't company in her way, so far as she went. Only you couldn't talk things over with her, not like with Piggy. And she couldn't cook. I don't know why I am boring you fellows with all this talk, but really, sometimes one feels as if one could hardly carry on. It's not as if Piggy were a flapper, you see. I really did love her, Grummore, really. And if only she would have answered my letters, it would have been ever so nice.
Poor old Pellinore, they said.
I saw 7 maggot pies today, Palomides. They were flying along like frying pans. 1 for sorrow, explained the king, 2 for joy, 3 for a marriage, and 4 for a boy. So 7 ought to be 4 boys, ought it, what?
Bound to be, said Sir Grummore.
They were going to be called Aglovale, Percival, and Lamorack. And then there was one with a funny name which I can't remember.
That's all off now. Still, I must say, I would have liked to have had a son called Dorna.
Look here, Pellinore, you must learn to let bygones be bygones. You will only wear yourself out. Why don't you be a brave chap and catch your beast, for instance?
I suppose I must.
That's it. Take your mind off things.
It is 18 years since I have been after it, said the king pensively. It would be a change to catch it. I wonder where the Bratchet is.
Ah, Pellinore, now you're talking.
Suppose our honoured monarch were to start at once.
What? This evening, Palomides, in the dark?
Sir Palomides nudged Sir Grummore secretly.
Administer blows to iron, he whispered, while at high temperature. I see what you mean.
I don't suppose it matters, said the king. Nothing does, really.
Very well, then, cried Sir Grummore, taking control of the situation. That is what we will do. We will put old Pellinore at one end of the cliffs this very night in an ambush, and then we too will drive the place methodically toward him. The beast is bound to be there. It was seen only this afternoon. Don't you think, he inquired, as they were dressing up in the darkness, that it was clever, the way I explained about our being here, I mean to drive the animal?
An inspiration, said Sir Palomides. Is my head on straight?
My dear chap, I can't see an inch.
The Saracen's voice sounded uneasy.
This darkness, he said, seems jolly palpable.
Never mind, said Sir Grummore. It'll hide any little faults in our make-up. Perhaps the moon will come out later.
Thank goodness his sword is generally blunt.
Oh, come now, Palomides, you mustn't get cold feet. I can't think why it is, but I feel perfectly splendid. Perhaps it was those bumpers. I'm going to prance and bay tonight, I can tell you.
You are a-buttoning yourself to me, Sir Grummore. Those are the wrong buttons.
Beg pardon, Palomides.
Would it be enough if you were to wave your tail in the air instead of prancing? There is a certain discomfort for the forequarters during the prance.
I shall wave my tail as well as prance, said Sir Grummore firmly.
Just as you say.
Take your hoof off my tail for a moment, Palomides.
Could you carry your tail over your arm for the first part of the journey?
It would hardly be natural.
No. And now, added Sir Palomides bitterly, it is going to rain. Come to think of it, nearly always does rain in these parts.
He thrust his brown hand out of the serpent's mouth and felt the drops on the back of it. They drummed on the canvas like hail.
"Dear old forequarters," said Sir Grummore cheerfully, for he had plenty of whisky. "It was you who thought of this expedition in the first place. Cheer up, old Blackamoor. It will be much worse for Pellinore waiting for us to come. After all, he has not got a canvas hide with spots on it to shelter under."
"Perhaps it will stop."
"Of course it will stop. That's the ticket, old pagan. Now then, are we ready?"
Yes.
Give the step, then.
Left, right.
Don't forget the tantivy.
Left, right. Tantivy, tantivy.
I beg your pardon.
I was only baying.
Tantivy, tantivy.
Now for the prance. Oh, dear Sir Grummore.
Sorry, Palomides.
Yours truly will hardly be able to sit down.
Under the dripping cliffs, King Pellinore stood stock still, looking vaguely in front of him. His brachet, on a long string, was wound round him several times. He was in full armour, which was getting rusty, and the rain came in at 5 places. It ran down both shins and both forearms, but the worst place was his visor.
This was constructed on the snout principle, since it was found that if one had an ugly helmet, it frightened the enemy. King Pellinore's looked like an inquisitive pig. It let the rain in through the nostrils, however, and the water ran down in front in a steady trickle, which tickled his chest. The king was thinking. Well, he thought, he supposed this would keep them quiet. It was not very nice in all this rain and everything, but the dear fellows seemed keen on it. It would be difficult to find anybody kinder than old Grum, and Palomides seemed a friendly chap, though he was a paynim. If they wanted to have a lark like this, it was only decent to humour them. Besides, it was nice for the Bratchett to have an outing. It was a pity that it could never keep unwound, but there you could not interfere with nature. He would have to spend all tomorrow scrubbing his armour. It would give him something to do, reflected the king miserably, which was better than wandering about all the time with his eternal sorrow gnawing at his heart. And he fell to thinking about Piggy. The nice thing about the Queen of Flanders' daughter had been that she did not laugh at him. A lot of people laughed at you when you went after the questing beast and never caught it. But Piggy never laughed. She seemed to understand at once how interesting it was, and made several sensible suggestions about the way to trap it. Naturally, one did not pretend to be clever or anything, but it was nice not to be laughed at. One was doing one's best. And then the dreadful day had come when that cursed boat had floated to the shore. They had got into it, because knights must always accept adventure, and it had sailed away at once. They had waved to Piggy ever so, and the beast had put its head out of the wood and waded out to sea after them, looking most upset. But the boat had gone on and on, and the small figures on the shore had dwindled till they could hardly see the kerchief which Piggy was waving. And then the Bratchett had been sick. From every port he had written to her. He had given letters to the innkeepers everywhere, and they had promised like anything to send them on. But she had never sent a syllable in reply. It was because he was unworthy, decided the king. He was vague and not clever, and always getting in a muddle. Why should the daughter of the Queen of Flanders write to a person like that, especially when he had gone and got into a magic boat and sailed away? It was like deserting her, and of course she was right to be angry. Meanwhile, it would keep raining, and the water did trickle so, and now that Bratchett was sneezing. The armour would be rusty, and there was a sort of draught down the back of his neck where the helmet screwed on. It was dark and horrible. Some sticky stuff was dripping off the cliffs.
"Excuse me, Sir Grummore, but is that you, snuffling, in my ear?"
"No, no, my dear fellow. Go on, go on. I'm only doing my baying as well as I can."
"It is not baying I refer to, Sir Grummore, but a kind of breathing noise of a husky nature."
"My dear chap, it's no good asking me. All you can hear in here is a kind of creaking, like a bellows."
"Yours truly thinks the rain is going to stop. Do you mind if we stop, too?"
"Well, Palomides, if you must stop, you must. But if we don't get this over quickly, I shall get my stitch again. What do you want to stop for?"
"I wish it was not so dark."
"But you can't stop just because it is dark."
"No, one appreciates that."
"Go on then, old boy. Left, right, that's the ticket."
"I say, Grummore," said Sir Palomides later. "There it is again."
"What is?"
"The puffing, Sir Grummore."
"Are you sure it is not me?" inquired Sir Grummore.
"Positive. It is a menacing or amorous puff, similar to the Grampus. This paynim sincerely wishes that it were not so dark."
"Ah, well, we can't have everything. Now, march on, Palomides. There's a good fellow, do."
After a bit, Sir Grummore said sepulchrally,
"Dear old boy, can't you stop bumping all the time?"
But I am not bumping, Sir Grammor.
Well, what is then?
Yours faithfully can feel no bumps.
Something keeps bumping me behind.
Is it your tail, perhaps?
No, I have that wound round me.
In any case, it would be impossible to bump you from the back, because the forelegs are in front.
There it is again.
What?
The bump. It was a definite assault. Palomides, we are being attacked.
No, no, Sir Grammor. You are imagining things.
Palomides, we must turn round.
What for, Sir Grammor?
To see what is bumping me behind.
Yours truly can see nothing, Sir Grammor. It is too dark.
Put your hand out of your mouth and see what you can feel.
I can feel a sort of round thing.
That is me, Sir Palomides. That is me from the back.
Sincere apologies, Sir Grammor.
Not at all, my dear chap, not at all. What else can you feel?
The kindly Saracen's voice began to falter.
Something cold, he said, and slippery.
Does it move, Palomides?
It moves, and it snuffles.
Snuffles?
Snuffles.
At this moment the moon came out.
Merciful powers!
Cried Sir Palomides in a high, squealing voice as he peered out of his mouth.
Run, Grammor, run! Left, right, quick march, double march! Faster, faster, keep in step! Oh, my poor heels! Oh, my God! Oh, my hat!
It was no good, decided the king. Probably they'd got lost, or wandered off somewhere to amuse themselves. It was beastly wet, as it nearly always was in Lothian, and really he had done his best to fall in with their plans. Now they had wandered off, one might almost say inconsiderately, and left him with his wretched brachet to get rusty. It was too bad. With a determined motion, he marched away to bed, heaving the brachet along behind him. Halfway up a fissure in one of the steepest cliffs, with most of its buttons burst, the counterfeit beast was arguing with its stomach.
But my dear knight, how could yours truly foresee a calamity of this nature?
You thought of it, replied the stomach furiously. You made us dress up. It is your fault.
At the foot of the cliff, the questing beast herself, in a sentimental attitude, waited in the romantic moonlight for her better half. Behind her was a background of the silver sea. In various parts of the landscape, several dozens of bent and distorted old ones were intently examining the situation from the concealment of rocks, sandhills, shell mounds, igloos, and so forth, still vainly trying to fathom the subtle secrets of the English. Chapter 10. In Bedegraine it was the night before the battle. A number of bishops were blessing the armies on both sides, hearing confessions and saying mass. Arthur's men were reverent about this, but King Lot's men were not, for such was the custom in all armies that were going to be defeated. The bishops assured both sides that they were certain to win, because God was with them. But King Arthur's men knew that they were outnumbered by 3-1, so they thought it was best to get shriven. King Lot's men, who also knew the odds, spent the night dancing, drinking, dicing, and telling each other dirty stories. This is what the chronicles say, at any rate. In the King of England's tent, the last staff talk had been held, and Merlin had stayed behind to have a chat. He was looking worried. What are you worried about, Merlin? Are we going to lose this battle after all?
No. You will win the battle, all right. There's no harm in telling you so. You will do your best and fight hard and call in you know whom at the right moment. It will be in your nature to win the battle, so it doesn't matter telling you.
No, it is something else which I ought to have told you that is worrying me just now.
What was it about?
Gracious heavens, why should I be worrying if I could remember what it was about?
Was it about the maiden called Nimue?
No, 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 no. That's quite a different business. It was something I can't remember.
After a bit, Merlin took his beard out of his mouth and began counting on his fingers.
I have told you about Guinevere,
haven't I? I don't believe it.
No matter. And I have warned you about her and Lancelot.
That warning, said the king, would be a base one anyway, whether it was true or false.
Then I've said the bit about Excalibur and how you must be careful of the sheath.
Yes.
I've told you about your father, so it can't be him, and I've given the hint about the person.
What is confounding me, exclaimed the magician, pulling out his hair in tufts,
is that I can't remember whether it is in the future or in the past.
Never mind about it, said Arthur. I don't like knowing the future anyway. I'd much rather you didn't worry about it, because it only worries me.
But it is something I must say. It is vital.
Stop thinking about it, suggested the king, and then perhaps it will come back. You ought to take a holiday. You've been bothering your head too much lately, what with all these warnings and arranging about the battle.
I will take a holiday, exclaimed Merlin, as soon as the battle is over. I will go on a walking tour into Northumberland. I have a master called Blaise who lives in Northumberland, and perhaps he will be able to tell me what it is I'm trying to remember. Then we could have some wild fowl watching. He is a great man for wild fowl.
Good, said Arthur. You take a long holiday. Then, when you come back, we can think of something to prevent Nimue. The old man stopped fiddling with his fingers and looked sharply at the king.
You are an innocent fellow, Arthur, he said. And a good thing, too, really.
Why?
Do you remember anything about the magic you had when you were small?
No. Did I have some magic?
I can remember that I was interested in birds and beasts.
Indeed, that is why I still keep my menagerie at the tower. But I don't remember about magic.
People don't remember, said Merlin. I suppose you wouldn't remember about the parables I used to tell you when I was trying to explain things.
Of course I do. There was one about some rabbi or other which you told me when I wanted to take Kay somewhere. I never could understand why the cow died.
Well, I want to tell you another parable now.
I shall love it.
In the East, perhaps in the same place which that rabbi Jachanan came from, there was a certain man who was walking in the market of Damascus when he came face to face with death. He noticed an expression of surprise on the spectre's horrid countenance, but they passed one another without speaking. The fellow was frightened and went to a wise man to ask what should be done. The wise man told him that death had probably come to Damascus to fetch him away next morning. The poor man was terrified at this and asked however he could escape. The only way they could think of between them was that the victim should ride all night to Aleppo, thus eluding the skull and bloody bones. So, this man did ride to Aleppo. It was a terrible ride, which had never been done in one night before. And when he was there, he walked in the marketplace, congratulating himself on having eluded death. Just then, death came up to him and tapped him on the shoulder. "Excuse me," he said, "but I have come for you." "Why?" exclaimed the terrified man. "I thought I met you in Damascus yesterday." "Exactly," said Death. "That was why I looked surprised, for I had been told to meet you today in Aleppo."
Arthur reflected on this gruesome chestnut for some time. Then he said,
So it is no good trying to escape Nimue.
Even if I wanted to, said Merlin, it would be no good. There is a thing about time and space which the philosopher Einstein is going to find out. Some people call it destiny.
But what I can't get over is this toad-in-the-hole business.
Ah, well, said Merlin, people will do a lot for love. And then the toad is not necessarily unhappy in its hole, not more than when you are asleep, for instance. I shall do some considering until they let me out again.
So they will let you out?
I will tell you something else, King, which may be a surprise for you. It will not happen for hundreds of years, but both of us are to come back. Do you know what is going to be written on your tombstone? Hic jacet, Arthurus rex quondam, rexque futurus. Do you remember your Latin? It means the once and future king.
I am to come back, as well as you.
Some say from the Vale of Avilion.
The king thought about it in silence. It was full night outside, and there was stillness in the bright pavilion. The sentries moving on the grass could not be heard. I wonder, he said at last, whether they will remember about our table.
Merlin did not answer. His head was bowed on the white beard, and his hands clasped between his knees.
What sort of people will they be, Merlin? Cried the young man's voice unhappily. Chapter 11. The Queen of Lothian had taken to her chamber, cutting off communication with her guests, and Pellinore broke his fast alone. Afterwards he went for a walk along the beach, admiring the gulls who flew above him like white quill pens whose heads had been neatly dipped in ink. The old cormorants stood like crucifixes on the rocks, drying their wings. He was feeling sad, as usual, but he was also feeling uncomfortable because he was missing something. He did not know what it was. He was missing Palomides and Grummor, if he had been able to remember. Presently he was attracted by shouting and went to investigate.
Here, Pellinore! Hi! We are over here!
Why, Grummor? He asked with interest. Whatever are you doing up that cliff?
Look at the beast, man! Look at the beast!
Oh, hello! You have got old Glatizant.
My dear chap, for heaven's sake, do something! We have been here all night!
But why are you dressed up like that, Grummor? You have got spots or something. And what has Palomides got on his head?
Don't stand there arguing, man!
But you have a sort of tail, Grummor. I can see it hanging down behind.
Of course I have a tail. Can't you stop talking and do something? We've been in this damned crevice all night, and we're dropping with fatigue. Go on, Pellinore. Kill that beast of yours at once.
Oh, I say, whatever should I want to kill her for?
Good gracious heavens! Haven't you been trying to kill her for the last 18 years? Now come along, Pellinore. Be a good chap and do something. If you don't do something quick, we shall both tumble out.
What I can't understand, said the king plaintively, is why you should be in this cliff at all. And why are you dressed up like that? You look as if you were dressed as a sort of beast yourselves. And where did the beast come from, anyway, what? I mean, the whole thing is so sudden.
Pellinore, once and for all, will you kill that beast?
Why?
Because it has chased us up this cliff.
It is unusual for the beast, remarked the king. She does not generally take an interest in people like this.
Palomides, said Sir Grummor hoarsely, says he believes she has fallen in love with us.
Fallen in love?
Well, you see, we were dressed up as a beast.
Like likes like,
explained Sir Palomides faintly. King Pellinore slowly began to laugh, for the first time since he had arrived in Lothian.
"Well," he said, "bless my soul! Did you ever hear of anything to match it? Why does Palomides think she has fallen for him?"
"The beast," said Sir Grammore with dignity, "has been walking round and round the cliff all night. She has been rubbing herself against it and purring, and she sometimes curls her neck round the rocks and gazes up at us in a sort of way."
"What sort of way, Grammore?"
"My dear fellow, look at her now."
The questing beast, who had not paid the least attention to the arrival of her master, was staring up at Sir Palomides with her soul in her eyes. Her chin was pressed to the foot of the cliffs in a passion of devotion, and occasionally she gave her tail a wag. She moved it laterally on the surface of pebbles, where its numerous heraldic tufts and foliations made a rustling noise, and sometimes she scratched the bluff with a small whimper. Then, feeling that she had been too forward, she would arch her graceful serpent neck and hide her head beneath her belly, peeping upwards from the corner of one eye.
"Well, Grammore, what do you want me to do?"
"We want to come down," said Grammore.
"I can see that," said the king. "It seems a sensible idea. Mind you, I don't understand exactly how the whole thing started, what? But I can see that, absolutely."
"Then kill it, Pellinore! Kill the wretched creature!"
"Oh, really?" said the king. "I don't know about that. After all, what harm has she done? All the world loves a lover. I don't see why the poor beastie should be killed, just because she has got the gentle passion. I mean to say, I am in love myself, am't I? What? It gives you a sort of fellow feeling."
"King Pellinore," said Sir Palomides definitely, "unless some steps are taken pretty damn quick, yours affectionately will be instantaneously martyred, R.I.P.
"But my dear Palomides, I can't possibly kill the old beast, don't you see, because my sword is blunt."
"Then stun her with it, Pellinore. Give her a good bang on the head with it, man, and perhaps she will get concussion."
"That is all very well for you, Grammore, old fellow. But suppose it doesn't stun her? It might make her lose her temper, Grammore, and then where should I be? Personally, I can't see why you should want to have the creature assaulted at all. After all, she's in love with you, isn't she, what?"
"Whatever the reasons for the animal's behaviour, the point is, we are on this ledge."
"Then all you need to do is to come off it."
"My good man, how can we come down to be attacked?"
"It will only be a loving sort of attack," the king pointed out reassuringly. "Sort of making advances. I don't suppose she will do you any harm. All you would have to do would be to walk along in front of her until you reached the castle, what? As a matter of fact, you could perhaps encourage her a bit. After all, everybody likes to have their affection returned."
"Are you suggesting," asked Sir Grammore coldly, "that we should flirt with this reptile of yours?"
"It would certainly make it easier. I mean, the walk back."
"And how are we to do this, pray?"
"Well, Palomides could twine his neck round hers occasionally, you know, and you could wag your tail. I suppose you could not lick her nose?"
"Yours truly," said Sir Palomides feebly, finally, and with aversion, "can neither twine nor lick. Also, he is now about to fall. Adieu!"
With this, the unfortunate Paynim let go of the cliff with both hands and appeared to be sinking into the monster's jaws, but that Sir Grammore caught him and the remaining buttons held him in position.
"There," said Sir Grammore, "now look what you have done."
"But my dear fellow..."
"I am not your dear fellow. You are simply abandoning us to destruction."
"Oh, I say..."
"Yes, you are. Heartlessly."
The king scratched his head.
I suppose, he said doubtfully, I could hold her by the tail while you made a dash for it.
Then do so. If you don't do something immediately, Palomides will fall, and then we shall come in half.
I still don't see, said the king sadly, why you had to dress up like this to begin with. It is all a mystery to me. However, he added, taking the beast by the tail, come on, old girl, heave-ho! We shall have to do the best we can in the circumstances. Now then, you two, run for your lives. Hurry up, Grummore. I don't think the beast is pleased by the feel of her. Ah, you naughty thing, leave it. Run, Grummore. Naughty beast. Pah, nasty, nasty, leave it. Quick, man, quick. Come away, then. Don't touch. Trust. She'll be off in a minute. Come to heel, will you? Heel. Come behind. Oh, you horrid beast. Faster, Grummore. Sit, sit. Lie down, beast. How dare you? Look out, man, she's coming. Oh, you would you? There! Ah! No, she's bitten me!
They won the drawbridge by a short head, and it was drawn up after them in the nick of time.
Phew!
Said Sir Grummore, unbuttoning the back end and standing up to mop his brow.
Hoots!
Cried various old wives who were in the castle delivering eggs. Some of the castle circle could speak English after a fashion, including St. Turdlebach and Mother Morlan.
"We slick it, cowering, timorous beastie," said the drawbridge man. "Oh, what a panic's in thy breastie!"
"Aroint us," said the bystanders. "Bonny Sir Palomides," said a number of old ones, who had known of their plight on the cliff-ledge all night, without saying anything about it, as was their custom, for fear of being caught out, "is going to lay him doon and dee."
They turned round to examine the paynim, and found that it was as they said. Sir Palomides had collapsed on a stone mounting block, without troubling to take his head off, and was breathing heavily. They took it off for him, and threw a bucket of water in his face. Then they fanned him with their aprons.
"Ah, the poor churl," they said compassionately. "The Sassenach, the sable savage, will he no come back again? Gie him another drappy there. Ah, the braw splash."
Sir Palomides revived slowly, blowing bubbles out of his nose.
"Where is yours truly?" he asked.
"Here we are, old boy. We got back safe. The beast is outside."
Through the portcullis there came a sorrowful howling to bear out Sir Grummore's statement, as it had been 30 couple of hounds baying the moon. Sir Palomides shuddered.
"We ought to look out to see if King Pellinore is coming."
"Yes, Sir Grummore. Allow one sec for recuperation.
The beast may have done him a mischief."
"Poor fellow. How do you feel yourself?"
"The indisposition is passing," said Sir Palomides bravely.
"Not much time to waste. It may be eating him at this moment."
"Lead on," said the paynim, heaving himself to his feet. "Forward to the battlements."
So the whole party set off to climb the narrow stairs of the Peel Tower. Below them, looking small and upside down from this height, the questing beast could be seen sitting in the ravine which bounded the castle on that side. She was sitting on a boulder in it, with her tail in the burn, and looking up at the drawbridge with her head on one side. Her tongue was hanging out. Nothing could be seen of Pellinore.
"Evidently she has not eaten him," said Sir Grummore. "Unless she has eaten him."
"I hardly think she would have had time to do that, old boy. Not in the time."
"You would think she would have left some bones or something, or at any rate the armour."
"Quite."
"What do you think we ought to do?"
"It seems baffling."
"Do you think we ought to make a sortie?"
"We could wait to see what happens, Palomides, don't you think?"
"No leaps," assented Sir Palomides, "without previous looks."
After they had been watching for half an hour or so, the faction of the old ones grew bored with the lack of entertainment. They clattered off down the stairs to throw stones at the questing beast off the top of the wall. The two knights stayed on the lookout.
"This is a pretty state of affairs."
Indeed it is. I mean, when you work it out. Exactly. Here is the Queen of Orkney angry about something on one side. I could not help noticing that she seemed a little queer about that unicorn. And Pellinor moping on the other. And you're supposed to be in love with La Beale Isoud, isn't it? And now this beast is after both of us.
A confusing situation.
Love, said Sir Grummore uneasily, is a pretty strong passion when you come to think of it.
At this moment, as if to confirm Sir Grummore's opinion, a pair of enlaced figures sauntered along the cliff road.
Good gracious, exclaimed Sir Grummore. What are these?
As they drew nearer, their identity became clear. One of them was King Pellinore, and he had his arm round the waist of a stout, middle-aged lady in a side-saddle skirt. She had a red, horsey face and carried a hunting crop in her free hand. Her hair was in a bun.
It must be the Queen of Flanders' daughter.
I say, you two, cried King Pellinore
as soon as he had observed them.
I say, look here, what do you think? Can you guess? Whoever would have thought it, what? What do you think I have found?
Aha!
Cried the stout lady in a booming voice, archly tapping his cheek with her hunting crop.
But who did the finding, eh?
Yes, yes, I know. It was not me that found her at all. It was she that found me. What do you think of that? And you know what?
Went on the king in high delight.
None of my letters could possibly be answered. I never put our address on them. We hadn't got one. I always knew there was something wrong. So Piggy got on her horse, you know, and came hunting after me by moor and fell. The questing beast helped her a great deal. It has an excellent nose. And that magic barge of ours, can you imagine it, must have had an idea or two in its head, for it went back to fetch them when it saw that I was upset. How nice of it! They found it in a creek somewhere, and here they are. "But why are we standing about?"
shouted the king. He was so excited that nobody else had time to talk.
"I mean to say, why are we shouting so? Is it polite, do you think? Ought you two to come down and let us in? What is wrong with this drawbridge, anyway?"
"It is the beast, Pellinore, the beast. She is in the ravine."
"What is wrong with the beast?"
"She is besieging the castle."
"Oh, yes," said the king. "Now I remember she bit me. And what do you think?"
he went on, waving one hand in the air to show that it was bandaged.
"Piggy tied it up for me like 1 o'clock. She tied it up with a bit of, well, you know."
"Petticoats," boomed the Queen of Flanders' daughter.
"Yes, yes, her petticoats."
The king was convulsed with giggles.
"That is all very well, Pellinore, that is all very well, but what are you going to do about the beast?"
His Majesty was intoxicated with gaiety.
"Oh, the beast!" he cried. "Is that the trouble? I'll soon settle her.
Now then!"
he exclaimed, marching to the edge of the ravine and waving his sword.
"Now then, off you go! Shoo, shoo!"
The questing beast looked at him absently. She moved her tail in a vague gesture of recognition, then returned her attention to the gatehouse. The occasional stones which were being thrown at her by the old ones she dexterously caught and swallowed in the maddening way which chickens have when you're trying to drive them off.
"Let down the drawbridge," commanded the king. "I will attend to her. Shoo now, shoo!"
The drawbridge was lowered with hesitation. The beast immediately drew closer to it with a hopeful expression.
"Now then," cried the king, "you rush in while I defend the rear."
The drawbridge reached the ground, and Piggy was speeding across before it touched. King Pellinore, less agile or more bemused by the gentle passion, collided with her in the gateway. The questing beast ran into them behind, knocking the king flat.
"Beware, beware!"
cried all the retainers, fishwives, falconers, farriers, fletchers, and other well-wishers who were assembled within. The Queen of Flanders' daughter turned like a tigress to defend her young.
"Be off, you shameless hussy!" she cried, bringing her hunting crop down on the creature's nose.
The questing beast recoiled with the tears springing to its eyes, and the portcullis crashed between them. In the evening, a new crisis began to develop. It became obvious that Glatizant intended to besiege the castle until her mate had been produced, and in these circumstances, the old ones who had brought their eggs to market refused to leave the gate without an escort. Eventually, the three southern knights had to convoy them to the foot of the cliff, with drawn swords in their hands. In the village street, St. Turtlebach was waiting to receive the convoy, a raffish Silenus supported by four small boys. His breath smelt strongly of whiskey, and he was in tearing spirits, waving his shillelagh.
"Not a one more stories!" he was shouting. "Am not I going to be married with old Mother Morlan, and after having a fight with Duncan this minute, and never more to be a saint?"
"Congratulations!" the children told him for the 100th time. "We are all right also," added Gareth. "We are allowed to serve at dinner every day."
"Glory be to God! Is it every day, begor?"
"Yes, and our mother takes us for walks."
"Well, there now, praise youth and it'll come."
The saint caught sight of the convoy and began to howl like an Iroquois.
"Up the ribbles!"
"Be easy now," they told him. "Be easy, your holiness. The swords are not for fighting with at all."
"Why wouldn't they be?"
he inquired indignantly, and he proceeded to kiss King Pellinore and breathe on him. The king said,
"I say, are you really going to be married? So am I. Are you excited?"
For answer, the holy man twined his arms round the king's neck and drew him into Mother Morland's shebeen, not entirely to Pellinore's satisfaction, for he would have liked to hurry back to Piggy, but it was obvious that a bachelor party would have to be held in celebration. The whole Gaelic miasma had faded like the mist it was, whether under the influence of love or of whiskey or of its own nature as mist. And the three southerners found themselves accepted at last as individuals and guests, irrespective of the racial trauma, into the warm heart of the North. Chapter 12. The Battle of Bedegraine was fought near Saw Hote in the Forest of Sherwood.